This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As we're reminded from time to time, the rich are different than you and me. One of the reasons that the Wall Street Journal assigned Robert Frank to write The Wealth Report. And over time, he's learned that the number of millionaires in this country is now larger than the entire population of Sweden or Denmark, that there's a parallel country he calls Richistan, a land where people sneer at $50,000 cars, wear watches that cost $750,000, struggle to keep up with those even wealthier, and where all that money can cause as many problems as it solves. He also finds the people he calls Richistanis using their money in new ways, in politics, and in a new style of performance philanthropy. We'll take you on a guided tour of Richistan. Later on in the program, Napoleon's love letter to Josephine and Hemingway explains why bulls are better than literary critics, plus your emails. But first, the insulated world of the very, very wealthy. If you want to join the conversation about who these people are, why their numbers are exploding, how they spend their money, and how that affects you and me, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Robert Frank is a senior special writer at The Wall Street Journal. His new book is Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich. He joins us today from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
You note that you've also served as a foreign correspondent and write that you approach this assignment very much the same way.
Exactly. I was overseas in Europe and Southeast Asia for 6 or 7 years. And when I came back to the U.S. in 2001, it seemed that the wealthy had, in a way, created their own virtual country. So I decided to really approach the wealthy as I did Albania or Philippines or any other country I covered. And in a way, it turned out to be an interesting way to cover them because they are increasingly different from the rest of the population. They have 30,000 square foot homes. They have 500 foot long boats. They, in a way, talk their own language about household managers and personal arborists. And I wanted to be an outsider looking at this world without judging them.
Well, I wanted to ask you about some of that specialized language that I discovered in this book. For example, the word shadow boat. I've never heard that before.
A shadow boat is a yacht for your yacht. In other words, today's yachts are quite large, but they're not large enough to house all of the toys that today's wealthy want on their boat. So in addition to the usual jet ski and speedboat, they want their cars, they want a submarine, they want at least one helicopter. So you can't fit all that in one boat, so you need a boat to tag along with your yacht that houses all these other toys.
Okay. Liquidity event.
Liquidity event is the way in which most Richistanis get to Richistan. And we have a lot of information today about CEO salaries, but in fact, the way most of Richistanis get there is by starting a company and selling it, what they refer to in the wealth management industry as a liquidity event.
Mm-hmm. Instapreneur.
Instapreneur, somebody who starts a company, expands very quickly to a global market or on the internet, and then sells that company all within a matter of months. There's a fellow I profile in the book named Jared Polis, who started more than a dozen companies by the age of 30 that he had started and sold. So it used to be wealth was sort of incremental. It took a lifetime to build wealth and generate enough income to be wealthy. Today, you can make a huge amount of money very quickly, hence the instapreneur.
And that speaks to some of the important differences between today's Richistanis and some of the old money. We'll get into that in a bit. But I wanted you to describe for us the difference between mass luxury and hyper-luxury.
Well, if you look at companies like Gucci, Mercedes, Jaguar, these are companies that used to have very specialized brands that catered to the wealthy. As these companies have expanded and gone mass market, creating what they call mass luxury, the wealthy, in order to differentiate themselves from everybody else, have had to find new products that show that they're truly rich and not just merely affluent.
And there's a watch you describe in the book, the Crazy Hours watch. Tell us what this is.
This was a watch by Frank Mueller, and I had heard of Rolex and Patek Philippe, but I'd never heard of Frank Mueller. And Frank Mueller is one of these brands that only the wealthy know. You have to be a member of the truly, let's say, 100 millionaire club to really know the brand Frank Mueller. They produce a watch. It's a $20,000 watch where the two hand is where the six should be. The six is where the 12 should be. It's all mixed up. So it's virtually impossible to tell time with this $20,000 watch. So in essence, you have to buy a second watch to truly tell time if you have a crazy hours watch.
I love their quote from their spokesman. Well, we could easily sell more, but then our watches would become common.
That's right. And common is the last thing you want to be in Richistan.
And the phrase that you use, that they use to describe someone of lesser wealth who's clearly beneath their notice is affluent.
Affluent people are not members of Richistan. So I divide Richistan into three categories or three areas of Richistan. There's lower Richistan, which is $1 million to 10 million. There's middle Richistan, which is 10 to 100. And upper Richistan, which is 100 to a billion. And then Billionaireville is still developing sort of part of Richistan with at least 400 members. But each of these categories is very distinct from the other, and each group looks down on the other as not being quite worthy of whatever group they're in. So the affluent people, which are below $1 million, are truly not Richistanis.
We're talking with Robert Frank, who writes the Wealth Report column and blog for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is Richistan. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's start with Sarah. Sarah's calling us from Bridgehampton. That's on Long Island, isn't it not?
Yes, it is. I live in the very heart of Richistan. This is the Hamptons out here, where Mercedes-Benz are considered by my son the Hampton Chevy. And that's what the high school kids call. Our children do live indeed in a parallel universe here because, you know, everybody drives a Mercedes. They're passing me right now. You have to stand out by having a Maybach or
right.
a Bentley, but even the Bentley isn't that good. It's astonishing. Lamborghinis, Maseratis, handmade cars of all sorts are out here in every color. It's fascinating to watch on weekend.
And of course, the yachts we were talking about, are they in evidence there on the...
Not so much. There are some people with very large yachts, and they put them off Sag Harbor. What people here have, and believe it or not, even contractors who are doing so well at the multi-million dollar homes, they own private jets or shares in private jets. And they go all over the place. It's fascinating.
Robert Frank,
you new trend.
Robert Frank, you write about, in fact, the was it the Google billionaires who decide to buy a 767, a huge wide body jet, because they argue it's cheaper than the price of the jet that they could buy from Learjet.
Right. I call it pragmatic extravagance. They said they did a cost analysis of sort of square foot per dollar, and they realized if they bought a commercial wide body jet, it was actually cheaper for them to buy than to buy a G5 or a G2 or a Citation. And they wanted to outfit this jet with twin California beds, and they wanted to put in hammocks and all sorts of crazy things. And, you know, today, again, having a private jet is, I wouldn't say common, but among this crew, it's not so special. So what we're seeing today are people buying much larger jumbo jets to outfit for personal use. I wrote a column not long ago about somebody in the Middle East who's buying a jet, and they're putting in a jacuzzi in the back of this private jet.
And what Sarah was saying about some of the trickle-down effect, you described a stonemason, I think it was in Greenwich, Connecticut, who was in the store buying a Ferrari?
This was fascinating. I was in Greenwich doing a story about hedge funds because Greenwich has become the hedge fund capital of the world. And I was in the Ferrari dealership expecting a hedge funder to walk in. And sure enough, a customer walked in and they wanted to buy a Ferrari. And I asked the dealer, I said, oh, can I find out who it is? So I walked out and it turns out it was a stonemason. And I just couldn't believe how a stonemason had raised enough money to buy a Ferrari. So I asked him, you know, how are you so successful? And he said, well, there are so many big homes being constructed in Greenwich that they're building walls, they're building marble grottos, they're building elaborate bathrooms, and they need stonemasons for all this work. So he had become probably a millionaire because of all the trickle-down from the hedge funders in Greenwich. And I was astounded. I couldn't believe it.
Sarah, does that sound...
That is not unusual here in the Hamptons. Not at all. It's astonishing to see the shift, you know, how people who were ordinary working people whose fathers were blue-collar workers who are now themselves living in grand houses, buying second homes all over the place, and whose children walk around looking like the preppy set 30 years ago. It's fascinating.
Sarah,
it's really shifted. And yet we have abject poverty, too, in our midst.
Mm. Do you have a shadow car carrying your scooters behind you, Sarah?
No, I don't. But we can't handle the very large jets out here, so everybody's on those little G5s or Citations. They buzz our skies. You should see them on the weekends. Zoom overhead.
And a lot of these airports have gotten so crowded now with private jets that they're having to spill over into alternative investments and expand the runways. In Aspen, during the peak season, they have three other airports where they have to divert planes because there's simply not enough parking space for all these planes.
Sarah, thank
you. We have such a traffic problem. That's why they're using helicopters as well as the jets. And thank you.
Thanks very much, Sarah. And I wanted to ask you about that trickle-down effect. You describe it as a plutonomy.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of suspicious people. When you talk to economists about how much trickles down, there's a lot of debate about whether it really does trickle down. But the plutonomy is something, it was a theory developed by a Citigroup equity analyst. And what he says is our economy is dividing into rich consumers and everyone else. And increasingly, those rich consumers make up the bulk of the spending. So if you look at the United States or Canada or the UK, which are all he considers plutonomies, most of the consumer spending is driven by the wealthy. And so when you look into the future, what stocks to buy, what companies to work for, what are the companies that are going to grow in the future, companies that cater to the wealthy are going to be the companies that succeed in the next 10 years because this market is so big and it's growing so fast.
So the distinction is going to be between Walmart and Neiman Marcus.
That's right. And Walmart is suffering and Neiman Marcus is doing great. And I think that disparity, as it's reflective of our larger economy, is going to continue to grow in all sectors of the retail economy.
Well, we'll talk about disparities even among the richest Annies and about their anxieties. Did you know that the wealthy have peer groups? Yes, support groups for decamillionaires. We'll talk with Robert Frank about his book, Richest Ann, and what he found while visiting the world of America's new rich. And take your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This hour, we're getting a guided tour into the world of the new super rich in America, what Robert Frank calls Richistan. That's also the title of his new book. There's an excerpt from Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich at our website. That's at npr.org/talk. Robert Frank writes the Wealth Report column and blog for the Wall Street Journal, and you're welcome to join the conversation. Are you a resident of Richistan? Do you hope to get there someday? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org and check out our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Chris. Chris with us from Bend, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
I think that your author should change the scale and drop everybody off the $1 to $10 million range and just start at $10 million because I'm a millionaire and I certainly don't feel rich here in Bend.
Mm-hmm. Robert Frank, a million sure ain't what it used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very good point that he makes. A lot of people say that wealth today doesn't start until at least $10 million. And I included single-digit millionaires in Richistan just for the sake of argument. It was easier to measure because government stats really start at $1 million. But you're right. Many people today, given inflation, given what it costs to send your kids to private school, live in a nice house on either coast, go to nice resorts, you really, people say, have to have at least five, probably $10 million to be considered wealthy today.
Mm-hmm. I live in a very modest neighborhood in Bend. My house is 3,000 square feet or 2,900, which isn't huge. The yard is just a postage stamp, and I live the whole neighborhood is like this. And, I'm 55. I'm worried about my retirement.
It's funny.
I'm going to live another 40 years, maybe, or 35 years. And my parents lived, they're still alive in 87 and 85. So, it's a long time to, there's no retiring for me.
Right. It's an interesting point. One of the chapters in the book is about this whole phenomenon called wealth peering. And they're essentially group therapy or self-help groups for the wealthy. And one group that I visited and wrote about in the book is a group of people worth $10 million or more. They meet in New York City every month. And they sat around a table, and essentially they all sat around and said, you know what, we probably don't have enough money. We're worried that we're not going to have enough for retirement. And I'm sort of sitting in the back saying, wait a minute, you know, you have
you've
at least
be 10, kidding me. Yeah.
$10 and $20 million. I think you'll be okay. But they were profoundly and genuinely worried that they were running out of money. And I think they were experiencing the anxiety that you're experiencing even at a higher level of wealth.
Here's the issue. Once you get wealthy, everything is more expensive.
Right.
You do write about that as well, that there's a separate inflation rate for the very wealthy.
The inflation rate for millionaires is twice the inflation for the regular economy. Why is that? It's because demand for these goods, whether it's the Mercedes, whether it's the house on the ocean, whether it's the nice Chanel bag, whether it's the private school, there's so much demand for these items that the prices are going up at a much faster rate than the overall economy.
Well, Chris, sorry to bring you that depressing news.
I'm depressed, but I'm sure I'll survive. But thank you very much. I'm going to go out and get a copy of the book today.
Okay, thanks
thank
very
you.
Much. And it was interesting, as one of the things you cite in the book was a survey that said no matter how much money they had, like Chris, if you had $1 million, you thought, well, how much money need to be secure? Well, maybe $2 million. If you had $5 million, you thought, well, maybe $10 million. In fact, whatever amount you had, twice that amount was what you thought you would need to be actually secure.
I don't know whether that's human nature or something about our economy, but it was so fascinating that no matter what level of wealth somebody had, it was always twice what they had. When you said, what would it take for you to be comfortable? How much is enough? And when you ask anybody that question, they always pick their current wealth level and at least double it. So even if you went up to $10 million, they would say 20. And economists say that's twice your wealth level is probably the amount that you can reasonably imagine that you would have. And so that ends up being the amount that they quote in the survey.
Here's an email from Patrick in Dubuque, Iowa. What obligation, if any, do citizens from Richistan have in giving to the poor, either social or moral? If one becomes rich, how is one socially obligated to give? How do the rich feel about this?
It's a great question, and it's an increasingly important part of the culture of wealth today. If you look at not just what Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are doing, they're giving away the vast majority of their billions of dollars to charity. But even below that, at the millionaire level, philanthropy is sort of the new black. It's the new fashion among the wealthy. And it's not just writing a check to the United Way or the Red Cross. They're engaged in what I call performance or control freak philanthropy. They don't want to just write a check and let it go and get the plaque. They want to be involved in every step of the way of how their money is being spent and what impact it's having on the community. So the good thing about Richistan, the good news here, is that the rich are giving back and they're starting to feel some sense of responsibility toward the larger community.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, this performance philanthropy is upsetting a lot of the status quo NGOs. You mentioned the United Way and the Red Cross, in the same way that these same entrepreneurs upset the business world when they entered it.
Exactly. There's a fellow in my book I profile, Philip Berber, who is the incredible person, probably my favorite person that I interviewed in the whole book. And he was a dot-com guy, sold his business to Chuck Schwab for hundreds of millions of dollars, started a fund essentially to help poverty in Ethiopia. And he didn't write a check to CARE. He didn't go to UNICEF. He did it on his own. He hired an Ethiopian and went to the country and asked the people, what do you need and how can I fund it? And he measures his company and he goes about his business exactly as he did his dot-com business. And it's working. And that's kind of, you know, it's freaking out the bigger charities.
Hmm. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Steve. Steve with us from Ogden, Utah.
Well, I'm a longtime listener, and what a phenomenal story that you have going on. I come from a different end of it. I married into the operative word was X. I married into a very wealthy family whose father was a turnaround specialist in the late 80s and had some 60 or 70,000 employees. And I was a blue collar guy working in the San Fernando Valley in Southern California. Came out to another state to work. Met the daughter, and she literally just swept me off my feet. Fly me out to New York.
So your wedding was your liquidity event.
Everything to come out to this new illusion, and the marriage lasted about 72 months because what I found in these mega wealthy families, especially the children of them, is that they'll have a car, they'll run the car out of oil, and leave the car, buy houses, not pay the mortgages, buy clothes, not do the laundry, just buy new clothes, and I went literally insane. trying to figure out what it was that motivated somebody with money that wanted more money. And the father wasn't much different. If you got involved with him in any financial deals whatsoever, you would be crushed financially and emotionally and spiritually crushed if you did business with him. Take over the company, and either it was done illegally or done through financial manipulation, and they would take it, and the parties involved would literally be ruined. And much of the wealth that I found that is derived is somehow manipulating others. They get what they want, and then leave everybody else just penniless, and they walk off and have no moral ethical scruples in order to get what they want.
The other interesting thing you raise is the issue of inherited wealth. Inherited wealth in this country was, for decades after the World War II, a huge portion of the wealthy. Some estimates up to half or even more than the wealth in this country was inherited. Recently, that's dropped to about 10%. But that's probably going to go up again as we see the baby boomer parents leave something like $15 trillion to their kids. The question is, how do you raise all these kids not to be the next Paris Hilton?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and, this is awful. Absolutely awful. Anyone that ever wants to think they want to claw their way up the financial food chain, beware, because the feeding trough is full and you will be part of the meal.
Yeah, and
that's my comment. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks so much for the call, Steve.
The way that a lot of these parents are trying to deal with this issue is, these are people, most of whom grew up middle class. They didn't inherit money. Now they have money, and they're raising kids of privilege. They want to instill their working middle class values in their kids while at the same time showering them with everything, every car and every toy that they want. So what they're doing is they're sending them to special schools to get them educated to be rich kids.
And as you report, with mixed success. But here's an email on this point we got from C. Weiser in California. I'm a pediatrician. My family and I relocated 2 years ago from the East Coast to Napa for a job reasons. Back in Baltimore, we were well off. But here in my 10-year-old son's classmates' parents are not only rich winery owners, which I'd expected, but also dot-com zillionaires. His best friend is the child of one of the founders of AOL who relocated here, too. Has it affected the kids? Oh, my God, yes. The richest kids and, of course, their parents choose to associate only with those of similar wealth, so popularity and cliques are based on money.
It's a tough thing, and I don't think that anyone's figured out the answer. For today's wealthy, they're making fortunes at a young age, so they're raising kids who, from the time of their birth, are raised in an incredibly privileged environment. In Palm Beach, I went down there, and you go to the Palm Beach Day School or you go to the local resort, and there's this whole other rich resort and poolside experience for rich kids. And it's something that most kids never have growing up. There was a child in New York, I talked to the parents, who the 11-year-old daughter said to her dad, "Dad, for my 11th birthday, I want to go on a commercial flight." And the dad said, "Why? We have our own jet." And she said, "Well, I want to see what the inside of an airport looks like, and I want to see what the inside of a big plane looks like." She'd never been on a regular plane or been through a regular airport. So you're raising these kids in this bubble of wealth, and no one's quite figured out how to give your kids the things you didn't have but also not raise a spoiled brat like Paris Hilton. And so there's a whole industry now built up around this new parenting dilemma.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with Rob. Rob's with us from Turlock, California.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
I was just wondering, is there a certain percentage of the really wealthy, are they family-oriented based, single male, single female, homosexual males, and how many of them, are there many females out there that are single and extremely wealthy?
You're hoping to get lucky, Rob?
Possibly.
All right. What are the demographics of the Richistan?
Richistan is much more diverse than the wealthy of old. So in other words, in terms of gender, it's probably about 60% male, 40% women in terms of self-made or people who made their money. They tend to be married with kids, 2.5 kids on average. They tend to be young. They're in their 40s and 50s. And as I said before, they tend to be self-made. They didn't inherit their money. They started their own companies. They worked very hard for what they got. And they want to spend it. They want to enjoy their money.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Thank you very much.
And indeed, spending, there is an keeping up with the Joneses, that's one thing. Keeping up with the Gateses, that's more difficult.
Yeah, I take the example of yachts. Not too long ago, let's say 5 or 7 years ago, a 100-foot yacht was a pretty big deal. I spoke to a Texas yacht owner in Florida who said, you know, when I launched my yacht, it was 100 feet. It was a big deal. We had a party. We had a christening. He would go down to the Bahamas and the Caribbean, and it was a big deal. And we were sitting on his boat next to boats that were 2 and 3 times bigger. He said, my 100-foot boat is like a dinghy compared to these other boats. And I was thinking, at what other time in history would somebody call their 100-foot yacht a dinghy?
We're talking
today we have boats that are 400 and even 500 feet long.
We're talking with Robert Frank about his new book, Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And in fact, you draw some distinctions between old money and new money. Old, you said, was characterized by modesty, tradition, public service, charity, sophisticated leisure. New has the middle class ethic, self-made fortunes, big spenders, younger, richer, and harder working.
I went down to Palm Beach, and the whole black tie ball scene in Palm Beach to me was a good petri dish or metaphor for what was happening with new and old money. And there was a ball down there called the Red Cross Ball, which had been founded by Marjorie Merriweather Post and was the blue blood occasion every single year in Palm Beach. Well, 2 years ago, it was taken over by a nouveau riche named Simon Fireman. He essentially bought rights to the ball, took it over, and the entire Blue Blood Society of Palm Beach boycotted. It was a nightmare. But this is happening in Greenwich. It's happening in New York. Anywhere where there's old money, new money is completely eclipsing the old money, both in terms of its wealth and its social stature.
Speaking about that Red Cross ball, there's a great quote in your book of somebody saying, last year was bad enough they had people from Boca. This year they have people from Del Rey. Can you imagine?
Yeah, and you couldn't see the sneer on the woman's face as she said that. It was just appalling that anyone from outside of the island of Palm Beach would be accepted at that ball.
Liz in Hercules, California emails, what fascinates me about the rich is the salespeople who have to cater to them. My son was interested in cars, so I took him to a Jaguar dealership just so he could measure up the stats and the design. The salesperson, when we entered, stared at me, then at my son, who looked past my shoulder to what car I had drove up in. It happened to be a rental. We were visiting another state. The salesman turned up his nose and asked if we lived in the area. With great satisfaction, I said, no, we're visiting our second home. He seemed to relax a bit, but I still felt sorry for him.
Defining and figuring out who's wealthy today based on their clothes, based on their haircut, based on their manners is impossible. There's a guy I talked to named Tim Blixith. He's a billionaire. He goes into a shop with his son to buy a suit for his son's graduation. And Tim never wears a suit. In fact, most of the time he's in a Hawaiian shirt and beat-up stained shorts and sandals. They go into the store and they essentially get kicked out of the store. And so here's a billionaire getting kicked out of a suit store. And so he said he got in his convertible Rolls Royce and waved to the guy as he drove by. But today, those old status signifiers of what you're wearing, how you speak, what your mannerisms are, those no longer hold true. It's very hard to tell who's wealthy. So those salespeople today, I'm surprised at that, because today's salespeople really have to just assume that anyone who comes in could be a billionaire.
Let's get one last call in. This is Sarah. Sarah with us from Syracuse, New York.
Yes, hi. I'm a professor of public policy, and I wanted to ask a question about the role of policy in creating the super wealthy. The conversation so far makes it sound as though these are self-made people. But in reality, a lot of the tax laws and other kinds of laws that the Senate and the Congress has passed and President Bush has enacted have created this class of people.
Robert Frank writes a lot about that. Robert?
That's the sort of classic Kevin Phillips argument. He wrote a book called Wealth and Democracy, where he says that most wealth today is the result of inheritance or government policy, that the taxes and government shifts of wealth really create the wealth. I do give some credence to that argument, and there is some evidence of that. But if you really drill down and interview today's wealthy, I didn't see much evidence that tax policy plays a huge role. Obviously, it plays a role, or that government contracts or government decisions play a huge role in wealth. So much of today's wealth is truly independent of government. And while government helps as a catalyst for some of that, I think if you change tax policy, you're still going to see huge increases in wealth and wealth disparity in coming years.
All right. Sarah, I know you will probably disagree, but frankly, we're out of time. So we'll reserve that for another show. But thanks very much for the call. And Robert Frank, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having
me. We appreciate the tour, guided tour. The book is Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich. Robert Frank is a special senior writer for The Wall Street Journal, where he writes a blog and a column called The Wealth Report. Up next, a treasure of old letters found stashed in a Swiss laundry room. 500 years of history are up for sale, including a love letter from Napoleon and a letter of condolences written by John Donne in 1624. Plus the letters in our inbox, your emails. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.